Hey, y'all, how's it going?
Welcome to the show.
Is there already time for the show already?
Man.
Even when the show is late in the afternoon, well, I don't know, 2 o'clock ain't late, but I guess I never do prepare for the show until the very last minute. Might as well do it when I first roll out of bed, same difference. It's still a good afternoon song, as much as it's a pretty good morning song, too. Should have learned how to play music. Wouldn't sound anything like this, probably. Still. Got my priorities all mixed up. Oh, well. Hey, at least I got an interview show. That's pretty cool. Phil Weiss is going to be here. How cool is that? Man, I forgot to even update Facebook and Twitter and all of that. I better tell the people. Today, Philip Weiss. Oh, we are Facebook friends. I didn't realize that. There you go. And Sheldon. Sorry, I'm really bad at things. Sheldon. Rich man. Alright, I don't think he's that rich. 3 to 5 Eastern at Liberty Express Radio.com. That's as good as I'm going to do live on the air. You can also hear this on No Agenda and at ScottHorton.org and all that as well, of course, so. Alright, let's see if I can get a little bit more people to tune in here. I think Weiss is on Twitter, isn't he? Philip Weiss? You know what he is? I bet he's Mondo Weiss. Right? There you go. And this is, I know, a really crappy way to start a radio show, but hey, that's how I do it. Crappily. All right, there. Now I'm done tweeting. I've tweeted. Retweet me! For crying out loud. I'm at Scott Horton. No, I'm not. I'm at twitter.com/ScottHortonShow. twitter.com/ScottHortonShow. Retweet me to all the people who follow you on there. I'm at facebook.com/ScottHortonShow, too. Re-Facebook me. And on YouTube, saying the same old thing, only stand-up version. All right. Anyway, saving grace. Philip Weiss is going to be here on the show. We're going to talk bad about Israel's stupid government. It was a pain in the whole world's ass. Stupid Israeli government. And then also our good friend Sheldon Richman is going to be here to talk about Obamacare, the Israeli government of healthcare. These Democrats, I'm telling you. Anyway, good old Sheldon. He's got such a good take on it, man. As always. I mean, if you ask me, hey, Scott Horton, I heard that Sheldon Richman wrote a thing about Obamacare. Do you think it probably is any good? I would have said, yeah, I bet it's probably great. Well, just like in the estimation. Of course, it's plumb line libertarianism. Conserving liberalism in the very best way. So to speak, kind of a thing. Old definitions, if you understand. Forget what I said entirely if you don't. Anyway, Sheldon Richman, the plumb line. You know, I say Anthony Gregory is a plumb line libertarian. He says, yeah, but that's only because I'm a Sheldon Richmanian. Wow. So Sheldon Richman, then I guess he is the walking definition of libertarianism. What is libertarianism? Whatever Sheldon Richman concluded. That's what it is. You know, he'll be on to talk about the disaster that is the American healthcare system. Oh, and also how Obamacare is going to make it that much worse. Things have been horrible all along, but anyway, hey, anecdote, you know me, trying to survive as an independent entrepreneurial sort of show host here. My rates are going up and will be canceled, and then I'm going to have to get a whole new rate. And I don't have all the details yet, but best I can tell, I'm going to have higher premium and a higher deductible, like a much higher deductible, like a impossible to afford deductible. And then, oh, but maybe I'm supposed to feel like I'm real lucky that I'll be able to go and sign up for a welfare check. Yeah, maybe I'll just lay down and die. How about that? Yeah, see, we're raising your price, but we're giving you a welfare check. You and everybody. Well, why don't you just give a welfare check to the people who didn't already have insurance? Not like I can afford the insurance that I have. The whole thing is fascist gangsterism in the first place. Anyway, you know, I think I hate government, and then they give me more reasons to hate them more. Anyway, Sheldon Richmond, he's not a hateful guy like me. He's a nice guy. But he'll explain to you why I hate the Democrats so much. Coming up here on the show in just a little while. Now, speaking of hating the government, where the hell is this article anyway? I was trying to find it, and I can't find it. Maybe I'll find it. I know I posted on my Facebook page yesterday, I think. That was, it's about a lady in Virginia who had a fight with her boyfriend who told her, beat it. And had insult to injury, apparently, according to the news report. So, take that as far as you want. According to the news report, he threw her stuff out on the front lawn. Very rude. So she responded by calling the cops on him. Which, you know, Americans are wont to do to each other all the time. I'm telling on you, and I'm going to get you in trouble. And that's what kindergartners say. That's what all Americans say. I'm going to get you in trouble. So she called 911 on her boyfriend, who, according to the news account, hadn't actually done anything to her except maybe, you know, get some of her property grassy. So the cops show up. Oh, no, better. The 911 operator asks the lady, does he own a gun? So she says, yes, he does own a gun. So they don't send out Ponch and John, the partners, to go and separate the couple and see if he hit her and the usual domestic dispute rap. No, because she says the man owns a gun. Not he held it to her head, not he did anything with it, but yes, she confirms he owns one. They sent the SWAT team. Immediately, the sniper took up a position in the neighbor's yard across the way. I don't know if it was next door neighbor or across the street there. Whatever. Put their sights on the guy. He refused to come outside, which, you know, what he probably should have done is just pulled his pants down and bent over and put his hands up and backed out the front door like a good little slave of the SWAT team men who created him and can murder him anytime they feel like. But instead, he decided, no, screw you guys. I don't feel like coming out. You know? Which, in fact, maybe he was terrified. As I say, they already had the sniper rifle, you know, trained on him. He's got a paramilitary death squad outside of his house. They're in an armored truck. And obviously him and his chick are already in a fight, so he's already upset and whatever. But anyway, so he refuses to come out, according to the news, for approximately 40 minutes. He refused to come out. So they just killed him. And then they say that the gun was nearby somewhere, but he was not holding the gun at the time. They say that he lowered his hand. His hands had been on the screen door. Then he lowered his hand, maybe to scratch his rear end. But he was not holding the gun. It was not in his pocket. It was not on him at the time. A detective assigned to the case said he was not holding a gun. And the neighbors quote, it was very scary because I've never seen coming down the street a SWAT team. I mean, a SWAT team? Aren't those for killing people somewhere else? Not here. Wow, she said. I made up the last part. But that's it. There you go. And what do you do if you're a conservative with this information? I mean, I know Democrats are in power, so it's okay to pretend that you believe in liberty for 1 minute until the Democrats are out of power again, and then you pull off your mask and show us your Mussolini face underneath. But geez, you know, I don't know. Law and order. Super men, demigods, golden idols, the very best human beings on the planet, cops, kill a guy in a paramilitary raid simply because he's a gun owner. Now, if he had been a pot owner, then I guess all conservatives in America could all give each other big high fives. Yay, the cops executed another guy for smoking a plant that I don't like for whatever stupid reason. Because I like cops so much. Because I prefer beer. But in this case, the only reason the cops came, the SWAT team came, was because the woman who called 911 in the first place said he's a gun owner. So now, at least in Fairfax County, Virginia, apparently, if the police have information that the person that they're coming to visit owns a firearm, that is now, I guess, tantamount to a hostage situation down at the local bank. Or some other situation where you could actually imagine it being reasonable to use a pseudo paramilitary team of some kind. Although it probably even then isn't a good idea. But anyway. So how do you feel, conservatives? Oh, should I mention the guy's race? How much difference does it make if this man who was murdered by the SWAT team for being a gun owner was white or black? Guess you'll just have to look up that part yourself. But anyway, if you have a problem with SWAT teams being called out for every gun owner who gets the cops called on them, you might consider opposing SWAT teams. And they're being called out on other people, too. I never understood that about Americans and politics. Like, if you're a gay guy, the only political thing that you should have an interest in whatsoever is gay rights. Right? Never mind the war. Never mind guns. Pro or anti. Never mind sound money or inflationary or anything else. Whatever your identity is, that's supposed to be the only thing you care about. And in fact, people take it the opposite direction too, right? If you say you care about gun rights, people assume that you're a gun owner. If you're not a gun owner, then what do you care if somebody else has a right to defend themselves or not? Who would ever even consider such a thing? Whether someone other than themselves has a right to defend themselves or not? I'm a skateboarder, so my only interest in politics, apparently, is supposed to be lobbying governments to build me skate parks. Right? Whatever it is that you're into, that should be your... Why would you have any other interest in any other thing? About how any of the rest of this works. I'm a gun owner, so what do I care if the SWAT team murders drug users all day long? Murder them! Kill them all! But don't come for gun owners! Why, that would be an infringement on my rights! Because, you know, that's my issue, you all say. And the same thing for the druggies. You ask people who are smart about legalizing drugs about guns, and what do they say? Yeah, I think the SWAT team ought to go door to door taking everyone's guns away so we can all be safe after that. Oh yeah, kill all the gun owners. They're all just controlled by the NRA or whatever weird conspiracy thing. Something about them, their religion or their music or their beliefs or their... rural place where they live or something about them makes them illegitimate, makes their rights forfeit. They're not like me, after all. Why, myself? I'm a drug user, but not a gun owner. Say the liberals. So SWAT team, go and persecute gun owners all day long. And it takes someone very, very special. One in a million. The libertarians. To say, well, geez, I don't know. What about if I hate all cops and I especially hate all SWAT team members and think, actually, they must all have really tiny little pinky penises or else what are they doing wearing all that body armor playing dress-up costume like little girls? And I think that if you support the gun war or the drug war, you're the only people who should have SWAT teams sent to your house. How about that? Everyone should be exempt from having SWAT teams sent to kill them or their family members, except the people who support the SWAT teams and who support their use against drug users or traitors or gun users or traitors. I say no knock, 4 o'clock in the morning, death squads for all of you, liberals and conservatives who hate everyone else's freedom so much and care only for your own. And this guy's dead. Because somewhere the cops decided their new policy was if they hear a rumor that someone may be in possession of a firearm, automatic paramilitary SWAT team. No more Andy Griffith telling Don Knotts to cool it. No more cool it. Powell Doctrine. Escalate. Overwhelming force. Everybody suit up in your body armor and your camouflage and your sniper rifles and your machine guns. Because, you know, we have an American citizen who apparently threw his girlfriend out of the house. So let's go kill him. And now, how do you think she feels? God dang, I wanted him to get in trouble. I didn't say blow his head off his shoulders. And now she's got to live with that. Same thing with the guy that got shot in the stomach in Dallas. His mom called the cops on him. He was acting a fool, but he wasn't really threatening anyone. He was sitting in the middle of a cul-de-sac in an office chair like some coup. I think she said he had schizophrenia, the guy. Dallas PD showed up and shot him 4 times in the stomach. Don't ever call the cops on your loved ones. I remember one from probably 10 years ago now in Williamson County, Texas, where then the cops pretended that the kid had a knife and all of this. They executed him right in front of his own mom and dad, who had called the cops to help them. Come and please help us restrain him. It's a license to kill, that badge. Not like on TV. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at myheroesthink.com.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing, it's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire, the permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And you know what? Honestly, I gotta admit, I am a little bit terrified to say anything bad about the cops these days. Because I understand the fact that if I just angered one of them and they decided, somebody played them a clip of me talking and they decided they didn't like me, they could just come here and murder me and nothing will happen to them. I know that. And I know that they know that. They can just murder me if they feel like it. They're the police. They have a license to murder people, which is funny because, you know, when I first learned about James Bond and the license to kill when I was a little kid, it was explained to me how that's just fictional. Because no one has the right to kill anyone. The only time a person has the right to take somebody's life is in self-defense or in the defense of another innocent life, immediate defense of another innocent life. The government doesn't have the right to kill anyone, so how could they license one of their agents to kill people? They can't. Especially in America, where free human beings allow the government to exist by contract to protect their natural rights. This isn't the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. It may be a corrupt world empire that supports the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. But there's no divine right of them over our lives here, and yet de facto, there sure as hell is, because there's a conspiracy, a dark, evil plot between every judge, legislator, and employee of the executive branch in this country to protect themselves from the rest of us, and the richest of their patrons, too, of course. Only in the most extreme circumstances do they ever sacrifice one of their own to the public passion, you know, for to save themselves. Otherwise, they're all a bunch of Lon Horiuchis. They're all a bunch of Charles the Firsts. Although they cut his head off. The King of England was like, I got sovereign immunity. And they're like, no, you're dead. You're dead. How sovereign are you now, Mr. Head in a Basket, who we decapitated? Mr. Sovereign Immunity, who is no longer alive anymore. But that's how much immunity and impunity every single police officer in America has, and they all know it. And so, honestly, I am terrified of them. That's why I lash out this way. It's in a way, I fear that it'll be self-destructive. And the fact is, I don't have any drugs or guns.
I don't commit any felonies. I haven't committed any felonies. No one has any reasonable suspicion or probable cause on me at all. My only thing is, I'm trying to influence the other 300 million Americans to hate all cops as much as I do, for they are all corrupt, evil murderers. And the ones of them who have never murdered anyone yet, they're just waiting for their chance when they can kill someone and get away with it. And all of their buddies will help them get away with it. People tell me, oh, not all cops are bad, really? Show me one cop who showed up at the scene of another cop's crime and then arrested him for it. Show me one time that has ever happened. Occasionally, the chief will fire somebody or something like that. And one out of a million times, it'll get to a trial. I don't know when a cop is ever actually convicted of anything. One out of a billion abuse cases, maybe. Again, only because the local politicians find it in their interest to sacrifice this one guy for the rest of their greater good. But even when the camera proves that they're lying, even when the camera proves that they're liars and torturers, killers, they get suspended with pay. And the SWAT team guys, all they got to say is, oh, well, yeah, whoops, I shot a guy. What? That's it. You know that case in Detroit? They kicked in the door. They said they were looking for a murderer who wasn't even there. He was in a totally different part of the apartment complex or something. Had nothing to do with this family at all. Kicked in the door. Little baby girl, 7-year-old girl, sleeping on the couch. Think, for example, are there any 7-year-old girls in your life or any girls in your life who ever were once 7 and you remember that time and maybe what they meant to you at the time? The cops kick in the door. She sits up on the couch. What? They put a bullet right through her head and then blamed it on her grandma. Oh, the grandma tried to resist and pointed my MP5 Heckler & Koch submachine gun at this little girl's face, where I then blew it off, claimed the liar murderer cop who murdered a child. And the jury let him get away. That one actually went to trial. And the jury said, yeah, you're a hero. Go ahead about your day, hero. Well, she was a black girl after all, right? So, I don't know, is that still the three-fifths thing, or how exactly that works, but you know what? It's not even that, right? She could have been blonde. The point is, he was a cop. He can kill whoever he wants. Now, maybe if she had been a little blonde girl, the politics would have been a little bit different, and he might have gotten in trouble for that reason. But ultimately, it's not about the victim. It's about the cop. The cop can kill anybody. In fact, I think a cop could probably kill the president and say, yeah, but I got sovereign immunity. I'm a cop. He was black. He was coming at me. And everybody, the prosecutor would say to the grand jury, well, you know, the guy was black. The cop was a cop, after all. And they are our creators, and they own us, and they can do what they want with the rest of us. Now, I know the president is actually the chief of all the cops, in a sense. So maybe his sovereign immunity to be a cop who kills people would outweigh theirs, but it would be some kind of weird metaphysical, you know, contest of immunities and impunities. It's amazing to me that people still love cops. Just love them. You know, I think it probably, not that I'm encouraging this, but I think it probably is the case that if politicians started running on let's scale back the police state as their issue, I think that most of them would probably lose. You know, the police unions would attack them. And the Americans would rally behind their protectors.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Braswell Business Communication Services at FusePowder.com. Braswell Communications can provide a credentialed media presence for your company at industry conferences and trade shows, as well as support services and consultation for publishing, editorial and technical writing, business-to-business and marketing communications, research, and information campaigns. Braswell also does website development and complete web content maintenance to include voiceover audio and copywriting. Strengthen your business. FusePowder.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is my website. ScottHorton.org/chat. If you want to hang out in the chat room, I forgot to sign up. Anyway, tell everybody I said hi. ScottHorton.org/chat. Also, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. If you like podcasting archives of things, you can get the whole show or the interview feed from ScottHorton.org. More than 3,000 interviews now in the archives there if you want to check them out. And I hope I muted that burp out well enough. Okay. I don't know, man. I got different stuff I want to talk about, but I can't decide which I want to talk about. I guess I want to talk about the LAX shooter. I'm not really sure so much what I want to say about this whole thing. I don't know. The government and the media say that the guy is a run-of-the-mill truther type who, did this. And I guess that's plausible. I saw a quote. Actually, it was the NBC guy. I'm sorry, I'm spacing out his name. For Christ's sake, Horton, the name of the NBC guy. I can picture his face and everything. He's the... I keep wanting to say John Mitchell, but that's the ABC guy, and he's someone entirely different. Anyway, is it Pete some? Peter Mitchell, maybe? I don't know why my brain is failing so bad on this. Anyway, I think the NBC guy yesterday, who's been doing, you know, he's their guy on the LAX story. I should be in the chat room. They know who I'm talking about. Pete Williams. That's who it is. Pete Williams. NBC News. It's funny how my neurons break in different directions, man. I gotta take the long way around sometimes to come up with some of this stuff. Pete Williams was saying that some of this guy's friends, they never knew him to be a political New World Order kook guy at all. Which, that's pretty strange, because if you know anybody who's a New World Order guy, they want to talk about it with everybody all the time. And I say that as a former New World Order guy, who I ended up realizing that I was wrong about all that world government stuff back around 2003. That, nah, it's really a lot more complicated than that. Nah, it's not really about one world state. And yeah, I know H.G. Wells wrote some stuff, and there used to be an Illuminati, but yeah. But anyway, it could be that somebody decided, you know, they say he was depressed and suicidal, and maybe he decided he wanted to take a few bad guys with him or whatever on his way out. I suppose it's plausible and possible. I would say that, certainly any libertarian would like to see the entire Department of Homeland Security abolished, and maybe especially the TSA. But that doesn't make any libertarian a violent threat, really, to any government agent. Fact of the matter is that a lot of us quit flying. A lot of regular Americans have quit flying. And there are a lot of people who would love to hear a representative run on a platform of, I'm against the TSA, I think it's gone too far. A lot of people applauded Rand Paul when he complained about his treatment by them and hoped that, hey, maybe here's a senator is actually angry about it. Maybe something will change, you know? We all agree, all 300 million of us, libertarians too, but still, everybody knows how retarded this is, the way they feel up grandmas and little kids in their strollers and all of this. It's madness. You don't have to be racial bigots and whatever to find a better way to do it. After all, most American Arabs are Christians, and most American Muslims aren't Arabs. And so that's not the profile, right? Arab Muslims is, you know, you could very well be barking up the wrong tree, even if you're just looking for Al-Qaeda guys. Although mostly it's Arab Muslims, but in that group, but they could come from other places. And but anyway, everybody's grandma and everybody's little sister and all that, we all know better than that. And they get away with it anyway. And it shouldn't have to be this way whatsoever. And in fact, we have private security hired by the airlines under their contract, the way they work it out. We would not have that. We would have adequate security, and we would also have customers treated with dignity. And that's that. Give me a break. The whole TSA thing is a nightmare. And of course, you know, the Rachel Maddows of the world are going to try to use this guy against anyone who's opposed to the TSA from now on. But I think that's pretty ridiculous, you know? And I don't know whether it's going to stand. Another thing that's come up in all the coverage of this is that the guy, you know, part of his anti-New World Order thing that they claim was his note. The guy hadn't spoken for himself at all yet. They say they shot him right in the mouth, and that he's having trouble communicating at this time, which I suppose is possible. We'll see what his lawyers have to say and what have you, you know, coming up soon. He's alive, at least. But anyway, according to what they say, and you know what, assuming that what they say is true, that he had this note and that it defined him basically as a run-of-the-mill New World Order truther guy, it would make sense that he would complain about fiat money in there. Because, after all, you don't have to be a truther to understand the absolute scientific quantitative fact that the Central Bank of America, especially, is the number one biggest confidence scam, crime, pyramid scheme, fiat money ripoff, engine of war and oppression and destruction and everything wrong with the world ever. There's never been such an institution as corrupt as the central bank. And I don't necessarily mean in exactly just the way it operates, but in all the consequences of its operation. Virtually everything wrong with the planet Earth you can blame on the Federal Reserve and the Congress that created it. And you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist of any kind to understand that that is true. You could assume, in principle, we'll talk about this with Sheldon Richmond maybe on the show a little bit later. You can assume in principle that every single technocrat at the Fed ever only meant well. And that even if they came directly from J.P. Morgan's board of directors, they acted as though they were merely experts and they never favored their own home bank. And they only ever are technocratic people trying to do what's the right thing for America and the national interest. If you believe all of that, I'll grant you all of that. And then I still say the Federal Reserve is the worst invention in the history of mankind, because it's how they pay for the empire. George Bush told you, we're going to war, but don't worry, it's not going to cost you a thing. In fact, here's a $300 check. In fact, next year, here's another $300 check in the mail for everybody. As though that was your dividend from all the money we were making off of Iraq and all of the off of the Iraq invasion and occupation. And that all of the conventional wisdom about war being good for the economy must be true, I guess. Certainly George Bush believed that, or claimed to believe that. And yet the truth is that the time that you spend in the unemployment line now, or going hungry now, or trying to console your best friend whose life is falling apart because of the economic consequences of that big fake boom that the Republicans engineered to make the Iraq war seem free, then that's where you're paying your cost. And especially, you know, it wasn't the Wall Street traders jumping out windows like in the mythology of the Great Depression. I guess that did happen in 1929. A lot of rich people lost a lot of things, too, and took it out on themselves. But much more common, I think, in our era, although it doesn't get much coverage. But it's quite apparent to me as someone who just reads the wires all the time. And this is especially true in 2008, 2009, and the beginning of 2010, I guess, when, you know, the worst of the effects were really beginning to hit people, was just suicide. And among regular people, or, you know, maybe upper middle class, owns a business that was doing all right, those kinds of guys. Or people who are just laid off, whatever. And the economic consequences of that big boom and bust, the big fake boom of the Bush years, and the bust that came at the tail end. Remember, September 2008, Bush was still in charge. He didn't quite get away with it, with getting out of power before the consequences came due. And the consequence has been an epidemic of suicides and murder-suicides. Like I always told you about Empire, it's murder-suicide. Well, there comes the metaphor home. Because what happens is, and especially in America, where people mostly prefer to be free and responsible for themselves rather than half enslaved and dependent on the central state most of the time, they blame themselves even when it's all the government's fault that the economy is ruined. Geez, my business fell apart. My wife hates me. My kids won't talk to me. They're in foster care now, and everything's gone, and my employees are all homeless, and boom. Oh, first glug, 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 and then boom, and they blow their brains out. Oftentimes, and you know, if you got young ones listening, you know, I'm being a bummer right now. You might change it to top 40 or some crap, but they kill their kids first. They kill their kids, and then they kill their wife, and then they kill themselves. Out of desperation. Out of internalizing all of the blame for the economic consequences of the U.S. government and its inflationary central bank. And in fact, here's how it works. Very simply, the government just prints more and more money all the time. And then that money goes into certain sectors where the Congress usually determines it should be funneled, like into fascized, I won't call it socialized, I guess half-socialized healthcare, like into higher education, like into housing, with all their various laws that funnel the money into housing. And then that props up these giant bubbles in those sectors. Of course, the stock market, too. And everybody thinks that they're getting rich for a while. And then, as you know, everybody's familiar, right, with the boom and then the bust, but they just don't understand that it's the central bank that does this. The reason for the fake boom is because there's a lot of new currency. And it makes it seem like there's a lot of new wealth in some places, but it's not true. And then the truth comes, and the truth is that your price does not belong way up there. Your price belongs way down here. Blam. And Ludwig von Mises is the guy who wrote in The Theory of Money and Credit back 100 years ago that, hey, you could have a giant boom in this sector or that sector for 100 other reasons. But, he wondered aloud, what is responsible for the cluster of errors? In other words, how do you get 75,000 successful businessmen to all start making the same wrong bets at the same time? You lie to them with the interest rate about how much money is available for investing in their projects. So what happens is they invest in a bunch of projects that can't be finished, that will not come due, that would not have made sense to begin at all if real prices were being reflected on the market. And so they get caught up. And the thing of it is, and this is really a problem, and I'm part of the problem. The people who are really good on this don't on understanding the business cycle, the boom and bust and all that, they don't do a very good job. And I'm including myself in here for certain, of explaining just how bad this hurts regular working people and people even poorer than them. Because it hurts everybody. And generally speaking, the people who understand this are libertarians, and generally speaking, people who are libertarians are, you know, at least middle class and have an education and learned a little bit about this already. This is not generalized common knowledge throughout the society. You can't learn this watching TV. That it's the government central bank and their inflationary money that caused the boom and the bust. So what ends up happening is the people who do understand it typically don't do quite as good of a job of making it clear just how hard this is on, well, whatever. You understand what I mean. It's not just, you know, what they do. They focus on explaining that this is why all the banks are, you know, in threat of collapse. And this is the excuse that the government's using to bail them all out. This is what's wrong with the economy in more of an abstract sense. They don't focus on things like suicide rates. But I do. You know where I got that from? I've told this story before, but I like it. There's a book called Secrets of the Temple. It's written by a guy who's a former editor of the Washington Post and is writing at The Nation magazine, and who, in Lou Rockwell's words, well, he's a commie. and that's William Grierder. So, and by commie, Lou means he's a social democrat type, you know. Which, that's the same thing I mean when I say commie, too, so I'm not picking on Lou. But anyway, I'm picking on Grierder. Grierder wrote this book that's all about inside the Fed from the point of view of a Democrat. And point of view of saying that they just don't inflate enough, actually. And his whole criticism, he's talking about Volcker's term at the Fed in the early 80s, where Volcker was telling the whole country, you got to take, and the government too, you got to take your medicine. No more inflation. Oh, we're going to beat inflation, all right. And we're going to beat it by ratcheting up interest rates into 20-something percent and through the roof, in other words. And we're going to strangle every last bit of badly invested anything right out of business and start over again. And so that was really hard on the people. It was the right thing to do at the time, assuming the propriety of having a central bank at all. In essence, he was understanding that they were the cause of the problem with their artificially low rates, and he had to raise them. He had to lick inflation because it was just disrupting every freaking thing. But the point of this, too, is that a lot of people were really hurt. A lot of businesses that actually, on the margin, were good businesses, and probably in a free market, prices would have dictated that they would have stayed in business. But in waging a war against inflation and forcing a recession, not allowing a recession, but forcing one, a lot of good businesses were taken down with a lot of bad ones, too. And so, and it caused a lot of unrest. And of course, people who were, you know, already really rich, they could just sit back and make a lot of money off of the interest rate. And so all of Reagan's tax cuts didn't go to supply side, creating a bunch of new factories and employing people, which, you know, I'm against all taxation, but I'm just saying the supply side wasn't even supply side at all. It was just demand side for the rich. That was their era of, you know, diamonds and Porsches for people who had, and screw everybody else. But so anyway, Grierder talks about how at the Fed, they kept all these statistics of suicide rates, of bankruptcies, of divorces, of foster care for the children taken by the state, presumably out of circumstances where it became necessary. And they know that it's all their fault. At the Fed, they know that they are the ones pushing the levers, pulling the trap doors, blowing the smoke, and fiddling with the wires, and all of my other stupid mixed metaphors, for they're the ones attempting to control the economy. And when it's bad, it's because of them. And then, so in the book, It's actually the most liberal lady on the open market committee is saying we've got to relax the interest rate. We've got to lower it. We've got to lower it. We've got to provide some relief for people who are dependent, who cannot survive through this recession anymore. And then the rest of the men on the Fed, I think it was all men and her, and they're all more conservative than her, and they're all going along with Volcker, who, of course, is an extremely powerful guy. And their whole attitude was, when we see this increased suicide rate, when we see this these increased rates of foster care and homelessness and poverty and signs of real despair among the people, this is how we know that we're really doing the right thing. That we're willing to keep doing what we're doing anyway in spite of all the horrible consequences. This is the measure of our steadfastness. And whatever. Again, I hope I'm making clear. It's all within the context of the central bank and whether it should be inflating or deflating, and I'm saying neither. But the point, my real point being, they know the pain that they cause. They know that the suicide rate is not just a function of, I mean, I don't know. If you heard a thing on NPR where they were talking about the suicide rate, would the Federal Reserve even get a mention in there anywhere? Right? If they were talking about the Iraq War, would the Federal Reserve get a mention in there anywhere on TV? People don't understand. It's not even all that they're just liars in service of powerful bankers. It's that they don't even understand the connection. Here's another one I like telling. Sorry for the regular listeners for being real repetitive-like, but I dig it. And I've always sort of felt this way, but I was really happy to hear George Carlin say it because he said it better. And it was that America is stupid. And his proof was that the Americans, in just a couple of hundred years, and really only 50 or 60 or something since the end of World War II, took a pristine continent and they just covered it in strip malls. And yeah, you know what? There's a lot of decent people making a lot of decent livings out of a lot of strip malls and what have you. But that's not the entire point. The point is about what it all looks like. And we're willing, as a society, to just pave over everything. To spoil anything. And how, I think the way, I forget now if this is Bill Hicks or George Carlin, same mixing their two bits together, something like that. There's major malls and mini malls and strip malls connecting all the mini malls and the major malls and the whatever, whatever. And it's all so ugly. And then Carlin, especially what I like about it, if I remember it right, is he especially picks out Old Navy and Big Bath and Beyond. And I think that's from the 1990s, late 90s. And he's saying just how damned ugly they are. And he's so sick of seeing these gigantic concrete boxes that say Old Navy and Big Bed Bath and Beyond on them. And now, and here he is, he's a traveling comedian, so he goes to every dark corner of America. Everywhere he goes, the entire nation is now completely homogenized. Any bit of culture or soul or anything unique about any part of America, it's all just about been completely beaten out of us, paved over in a sense with these big ugly square concrete stores everywhere. And my thing of it is that it's really not fair to the Americans to say that it's all just because we're stupid. In a way, yeah. But the thing of it is that the people just don't recognize the phenomenon going on here, man. No one ever makes it plain that, hey, the last 40 years since Volcker, okay? Since Nixon took us off the gold standard even. That entire bubble of commercial real estate is a perversion in the market. We don't know what America would look like if we had a free market, if people were left to choose based on circumstances arrived at under market forces. All we know is the central bank has been shoveling trillions into commercial real estate this whole time. and that they paved over everything and turned it all into one big, stinking, ugly mini mall. So, that's just one example of something that, and there's a million of them, really, the war is, all the wars, that's the most important thing. But I try to pick things that, you know, people don't think of necessarily as having anything to do with the way that the government controls the money supply. I mean, look, I went to first grade, and in first grade, that's how they taught us fractions. The very first introduction to fractions is, why not? Quarters and nickels and dimes. And basic decimal points and places, right? I mean, it's perfect. And the way that they teach it in first grade is they kind of got to give you a little bit of the background of what is this stuff anyway? And why is it we use this as money anyway, right? And the way that they teach it is something along the lines of, well, it's got to be this way. And it's the government doing it, and so therefore it's all kosher. There's nothing to worry about it. There's not even an inkling that maybe there could be a problem. You know, if you have skeptical eyes, you might look at George Washington and say, now why would they need to stamp George Washington all over this thing to make me believe in it? It should speak for itself, shouldn't it? But it has George Washington on there just to say, well, it's the government, so you can trust us. But that's not the way I look at it. I don't trust the government at all. And especially not their money, since now I know a little bit about it. And the solution is obvious. You just have a free market in currencies. I guess you could try 100% gold standard, but I don't know if you could get the law to ever do that right. And I'm really not for having a Congress anyway, or trusting them with doing anything anyway other than stopping existing if we could get them to do that. But so competing currencies is the answer. Alternative currencies is the answer to the boom and the bust. But also here, I'll tell you this. There's a speech that I gave in Santa Monica that you can find on YouTube. It's at youtube.com/Scott Horton Show. And it's about the boom and the bust. And it's about how it's all foreign policy. The central bank is all about foreign policy. It was created to inflate the money supply to pay for World War I. Consequences came later. And then, of course, there's the inflation of the 20s, which was really just to help the Brits pay for their war, which caused the big bubble and then the bust of the 30s and the Great Depression. And then you had a big artificial bubble for World War II, which for various reasons, it didn't lead to quite the collapse because of all that work, manpower coming home and all the new markets that were created around the world and the whole new boom that took place. Anyway, I guess the bust sort of took place during World War II as well. But anyway, then there wasn't much of an inflationary bubble for Korea because they did it with a balanced budget, believe it or not, focused mostly on nukes rather than army buildup at that time. But then certainly for Vietnam and then the rest of all of the Cold War and the Reagan era Star Wars buildup, the Clinton era post fall of the Soviet Union, expansion of the empire, and the big unipolar moment there, and then the terror war. It's all wrapped up with the inflationary policies of the Federal Reserve. It's the only way they could get away with it. I mean, can you imagine? It was a 50-50 split on the eve of the Iraq war 10.5 years ago. It really was. There was the people who knew that Iraq didn't do 9/11, and then the idiots on the right who fell for it. But imagine if he had said, yeah, we got to raise your taxes by 30% to pay for this up front. They would have not been able to do it at all, but they made it seem free, and so they got away with bloody murder. Hundreds of thousands dead. And then we all pay later on.
Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support The Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Kotowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And, you know, it's funny, I didn't mean to just spend half an hour talking about central banking, especially when I've got Sheldon Richman on the line, and that's one of the things we're going to be talking about today, get his take on all that. I had a lot more news to cover. Let me at least mention the fact that tomorrow Jeffrey Kay will be on the show to talk about this new report about the doctors helping the CIA torture people. Do no harm, indeed, the great Jeffrey Kay. And I got a ton of NSA stories that I promise I'm going to get some good expert guests on, and we're going to catch up on all the NSA stuff later in the week. But now introducing our good friend Sheldon Richman. He is the vice president of the Future Freedom Foundation and the editor of their journal, their monthly journal, The Future of Freedom. Welcome back to the show, Sheldon. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, and once again, thanks for inviting me back. I hope you're doing okay.
I'm doing good. I really appreciate you joining us here, and let me tell the people here real quick about the dates of this cool thing that you're doing with Jacob here. It's the Libertarian Angle Tour, and I see that your first stop was the University of North Florida in Jacksonville. That's all you've done so far, correct?
That was last night, yes, and we are in Atlanta right at the moment as I speak, and we'll be at Georgia Tech at 6:30 p.m. Eastern tonight.
At Georgia Tech at 6:30 Eastern time tonight, and then Scheller College of Business. Oh, it is at the Scheller College of Business. And then, I'm sorry, I thought I had it here, but I do not have the whole schedule. But I'll find it while we're talking about other things, and we'll remind you by the end of the show.
I can tell you real fast, tomorrow night we're at the University of Georgia in Athens, Georgia. I believe that's at 7, but that can be checked on the website. And then the next night we'll be at the University of South Carolina in Columbia. And then Friday night we will be at NC State, North Carolina State University in Raleigh.
Great. So here's your chance, everybody. Go out and meet Sheldon Richman and Jacob Hornberger and Reed and Bumper's write-up of the shindig last night. It sounded like it went really well, huh?
Yes, it did. We had a nice crowd, and we liked the chemistry. The format seemed to work. You know, we never did a live libertarian angle. We figured instead of the two of us giving dry lectures, we would do this more interactive thing, and the people seemed to like it quite a bit.
Yep, it says here, topics range from the Fed, the Great Depression, FDR, and the gold confiscation, foreign policy, and how we can prevail in our quest to bring libertarianism to America. I sure like that.
Yep.
And
we did.
So,
it was fun.
And you guys know Jacob Hornberger has a great presence. He's a great speaker. If you've ever seen him give a speech, he always, keeps everybody on the edge of their seat and incredibly interested. And Sheldon, of course, is great, as you've heard a million times and you're about to hear some more of. So go out there and check him out, The Libertarian Angle on Tour. And we'll have, again, dates and times and things. We'll bring it back up at the end of the show. But I guess I will say again one more time that tonight it's at Georgia Tech, from 6:30 to 8 at the Scheller College of Business, room 101.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Okay, so here's the first thing I wanted to talk to you about is, did you see that there is a new interview of Michael Hastings' brother? I bring that up because I know that you were fans of Michael Hastings, and we were sort of fans of him together. Especially in the few months leading up to his death, actually letting each other know, hey, Hastings is going to be on TV and all that kind of stuff. So, I wanted to bring up to you this interview and ask you if you had a chance to see it.
No, I haven't. Tell me about it.
All right. Well, first of all, if you go to Pressing Issues, which is Greg Mitchell's blog,
the great Greg Mitchell, he has a link to it. It's at Salon.com, and then they link over to the original blog. And what it is it's longtime friends of Hastings' older brother, Jonathan. And apparently they knew Michael Hastings very well as well. Not as well as his older brother, I guess. But so they decided that they would do this really wide-ranging interview and talk all about, you know, get his brother to tell the whole story of his life, basically, and everything. But obviously, they start with the headlines first as well, and that is asking about the night of the car wreck and all of that. And the brother's story is that he's not suspicious at all. That if it happened in a vacuum, that, you know, he was writing about the CIA and everything. He had written about the JSOC and everything. And if it happened in a vacuum, he might be suspicious. But based on the context of what was going on with Michael Hastings that day and everything, he says no. He, in fact, had just hopped on a plane on a moment's notice to go to L.A. to try to bring Michael Hastings back to Vermont for treatment, because he was having, not just he was abusing drugs, but he was having a real hard time and some kind of manic episode, whatever. And he said he realized when he was there he wouldn't be able to bring him back to Vermont without a fight. And then, but he was going to get back to trying to convince him the next day. And then that night he went out, snuck out, and went and wrecked the car. And so, anyway, that was his brother's take. And I guess I had already pretty much settled on that conclusion myself. But, you know, if that puts anybody's mind at rest about it, I'm pretty sure I agree with the brother about that, especially hearing it from him that way.
Yeah, that does sound pretty persuasive.
I mean, it's a really sad thing that happened, and obviously, you know, there's probably a lot of bad people who were happy that it happened, too. You know, a lot of people who would have gotten him if they'd had a chance or something. So, you know, I think probably the best way to honor his work and his death would be to stay on their ass the way he would have. Mm-hmm. So
I agree.
Anyway.
I'll never forget the image of him when he was on, I guess, the Steve Kornacki show, probably just a Saturday or two before his death. It was pretty soon before it. Maybe it wasn't that soon. Mm-hmm. And you saw it too, I think, right? He was really feisty. He was getting his points in. He wasn't he was making sure he had his time. And at the end, when he was being thanked, he raised his fist. Remember, he raised his fist and smiled like,
"Yeah,
we're going to
triumph."
Yeah, triumph. And there's going to be more to come. And unfortunately, from him, there won't be more to come. Yep. Sad thing.
All right. Well, anyway, and I thought it was also interesting that, as his brother points out, that all the truthers who are cashing in on pretending that they know the real truth about this and whatever, none of them were interested in his work before he died, because he wasn't a truther. He did real journalism. And so none of them paid any attention to him whatsoever. But now he's their meal ticket, or at least a meal ticket, not, you know, the biggest deal in the world, but worth an extra $60 in Google ad clicks, right? So why not exploit a dead man if you can make a little money? That's how the saying goes, I think.
Well, unfortunately, I never met him. I miss him, though.
Yeah, he was a great journalist. I mean, we're all much worse off without him, that's for sure. Yeah. But anyway, it's kind of a weird way to start an interview, but I just thought it was quite notable, and I'll send you the link in the email there. I'll tell people here, everybody else listening, the website is uncouthreflections.wordpress.com, Uncouth Reflections, and it's interview with Jonathan Hastings about his brother, the journalist Michael Hastings, and you can also find, I guess, a shorter version of it at salon.com as well. All right, so anyway, you wrote this thing about Obamacare, and I'm so glad that you did, Sheldon, because, of course, you're right about everything because you're a libertarian, but also you're what they call, which to me, you're the plumb line, I don't know, but to everybody else and maybe to you, you're something like a left libertarian, which means you actually care about people, even ones you haven't met before, which is somehow supposed to be unique, probably among all humans, and maybe especially libertarians, I don't know. But anyway, so you have this article where it's so plainly clear that you would like for every person to be able to be taken care of if possible, and you share that sensibility with liberals, and you admit, unlike probably most Obamacare critics, that the people behind this thing, for the most part, mean well. If any of them are trying to sabotage healthcare to try to force us all the way to a single-payer system or any kind of thing like that, that would be some very, very small, you know, percentage anyway. This is supposed to work. It just doesn't work, and you know why. So tell us why.
Well, yeah, on the first part, I mean, I say in the beginning that I will stipulate that most of the people in and out of the government pushing for the Affordable Care Act, and maybe even for those pushing for single payer, are primarily motivated by this humanitarian concern. I don't mind conceding that. Now, that doesn't mean that some also see political advantage in it. That can be too. They can see that as lining up with their political interests. So I don't mind conceding that. I'm happy to concede that because at the same time, I'm willing to concede that people who oppose the Affordable Care Act don't, you know, hate the poor and downtrodden and want to make sure they never get medical care. You can't have a double standard. I'm willing to grant good motives. And I don't know these individuals involved, so how can I judge them as being cynical and merely want political power?
I'm sorry for interrupting, but that's your second point there is a very important one as well that I actually meant to build into my intro there, which was I generally respect Bill Moyers, even though I disagree with him on pretty much everything, but he's a well-meaning Democrat type. But I saw where he ran an essay about whether maybe just all right-wingers are mentally ill, because how else can you explain that they would be so upset that someone is just trying to make sure that poor people can have health insurance? Why would you be against that? You must be psychos. There's no other explanation for it. You're upset that someone else could be helped at no expense of yours?
Yeah. Well, that's right. And that's despicable whichever way it cuts, you know, to say the only reason you'd be taking this position is you're either pure evil or mentally ill. I mean, I have no respect for people that engage in that kind of argument. I will say, though, that I say this later in the piece, I don't like that. You know, one of the many things I disagree with conservatives on and right-wingers is that, and I heard Rush Limbaugh saying this just around the time I was writing the piece, that before Obamacare, we had the greatest medical system in the world. They love to say that. And when the Congress was under the control of the Republicans, I didn't see them touching the medical care system, even though the partnership between government and the insurance industry and the medical societies, you know, the medical profession, has been very, very close for many, many years, particularly at the state level, which means there's maybe some limit to what the federal government can do. But I never heard conservatives and Republicans speaking out about breaking up the regulatory cartels, insurance cartels in each of the states, or the medical, medical licensing. I don't hear them going after that stuff. So they didn't do anything about this system, which was getting more and more expensive and obviously hurting, therefore, lower income people. And this link to the, you know, employer-based insurance, I didn't hear them calling for breaking that stuff up. They only started talking about it when Obamacare came along.
Right, and the only reason Obamacare got passed in the first place was because the entire society agreed that something's got to be done because nobody can afford insurance anymore. It's ridiculous.
Right, and it's just stupid to say, well, we have the greatest system in the world, don't mess with it, especially when in 1993 the Heritage Foundation was pushing an individual mandate for buying insurance. Their answer to Clinton Care back then, Hillary Care back in 1993, was that people should be forced to buy insurance, and therefore they'll all be responsible. We won't need to have a big government bureaucracy. But Heritage Foundation was pushing the mandate, which they then complained about in 2009. And ever since. So there's a lot of hypocrisy on the right on this. But my point was that, and I think any decent person, I certainly don't claim any kind of special status here, any decent person would hope that that medical care could be affordable and accessible to everybody in a society. Who wants to see someone go without medical care? My point is that the state is not a good route to it. The state will screw it up for all the reasons we point out in other respects. The greatest protector is free competition. The greatest protector of individuals is free competition. That means no regulatory cartels, all licensing, all the stuff we have. So that's the direction we need to work in. That's what we need to achieve, free competition. We don't have competition. Obama and the advocates of Obamacare like to talk about, oh, no, it creates competition. That's bogus. You don't need to set up exchanges or markets. Markets set themselves up. People set up markets spontaneously. You don't need the government to do that. What we have is phony competition because government prescribes the product that needs to be offered, right? There's a basic insurance package that the government has defined. Health and Human Services has defined it, and there's all kinds of controls on prices. People, companies are not allowed to price according to risk. They're not allowed to price according to sex. Even if women use the medical, use medical services more often than men, which, as I understand it, is the case, you still can't charge them more for insurance, even though you know they're going to, cost more during a year. You can't the difference between the premium to an older person versus a younger person, that difference is prescribed by government and it can't be greater. In other words, we don't have true market pricing and we haven't freed the market. If anything, we've encumbered it even more than it was previously, which was already quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So this is not going to work.
And no, but the liberals are going to say that, Sheldon, come on, man, you're just being ideological here, that, oh, yeah, the market, capitalism is some magic thing that solves everything, but what about all the externalities, and what about all the, John Stewart was saying, hey, when you're sick, you can't shop around, you got to just go to the doctor, man, and whatever, so capitalism doesn't count, it's off in this case.
That's ridiculous, because for one thing, a lot of medical care is purchased not in the heat of an emergency. A lot of medical care, and you can make arrangements in advance of an emergency, since people know someday they may have an emergency. That's why they buy insurance in the first place. They can make arrangements for what happens. So it's ridiculous to make it seem like, all medical care is purchased, during the heat of an emergency where there's no chance to make any choice. That's certainly true, but the fact is you can do some planning in advance, and a lot of care, is not bought during an emergency. If you're deciding what doctor you want to go to for your physical, that's not an emergency decision. That's something planned, and then maybe months before you have your appointment. So that's kind of bogus. Look, when you say it's ideological, that's just a negative spin on, yes, I think in terms of principles. I understand how markets work, and I understand how governments work, bureaucracies work. And yes, I'm applying that understanding to this particular case because there's no reason to think it's unique. For the same reason bureaucracies are not very good at providing bread or shoes or all the things they tried to provide in socialist countries, communist countries. And I'm not saying this is communism, but I'm saying we know what happens when government tries to be the provider. It's not very good at it. And so I'm applying those principles. If you want to call it ideological, I don't mind that. But yes, I'm using principles. I think it's ridiculous to say we ought to approach every issue fresh and new. You know how people say, I'm practical, I judge everything on a case-by-case basis. That's a load of, because either the person is applying principles and not realizing it, because of them, they're just sort of implicit. You can't really judge things on a case-by-case basis because there are principles. Everybody knows that there are things that apply to whole set classes of cases. And fine, if they want to dismiss that as ideological, I'll accept the term ideological.
Yeah. Well, now, so how come my insurance is going up and they're telling me that it's going to go up even more and I'm going to have to change to a whole new plan next year if I'm going to keep Blue Cross crap that I don't even want in the first place but I have to have at all?
Well, I don't know yet previously, but in the cases I've been reading about, people who bought more or less, sort of high deductible, bare bones policies that didn't cover a lot of services they don't want. But now those don't qualify for under the standards set by Health and Human Services, which has to include a lot of things. And so therefore, even though there's this grandfather clause, there's a vagueness about if the company has significantly changed it since 2010, then it's not grandfathered. And so the companies are going to people like you or, there are other individual policyholders and saying, we're canceling your policy because it doesn't qualify under the Affordable Care Act now. We have other policies which you can shop for, but they're going to be more expensive because, everybody now has to have maternity services covered. Everybody has to have mental health services covered, which I have a lot to say about. I think there's a lot of bull there. And so services that you might have chosen not to buy in a free market, you're being forced to buy. That's why they're more expensive. Now, some people will be getting subsidies, right, if you're making less than 400% of the poverty level, there's going to be a sliding scale of subsidies. And so some people won't pay the full cost because of the subsidy, but that means other people will be paying, and the subsidies have to be paid for by somebody. Who's paying for them? That's the thing. The cost of this is all, so much of the cost of this is hidden. We don't know what the system's even costing because it's not. It's too diffused. It's not right out there on the price tag.
Well, yeah, sorry to make it personal, but yeah, they're raising my rate and then promising they're going to cut me a welfare check that I don't want. I don't want to be dependent on them in any way. I'm just going to have to suffer their price hike.
Yeah, you could end up being on Medicaid. I mean, I know people in the state I live, which is Arkansas, of people who have part-time work and maybe going to school, and they now are being put on Medicaid. They may not like that.
I want to move to Mexico like Bob Higgs and be free.
Well, a lot of people might be following him down there. That may be the reason he doesn't give out the name of the village.
Yeah. Well, I know sort of where it is, over there on the end of the Yucatan Peninsula or something.
Ah, okay. Well,
he mentioned it one time. I mean, the Yucatan Peninsula is pretty big, though, so I hope I'm not giving too much away. I don't know.
We should go visit him and then just stay. Yeah.
But now, so listen, we got about 7 minutes or something, and I was thinking that, and maybe I could be wrong, but you could disagree with me all you want. But it occurred to me that if we had sound money instead of a central bank that was the cause of the giant boom and bust dislocations that everybody has to suffer through every few years, then maybe you wouldn't even have this kind of call for, in this sort of healthcare crisis in the first place. You wouldn't have people calling for this kind of horrible solution that just makes everything worse. We could have settled for bad enough.
Well, that certainly aggravates things, but there's a lot of bad stuff just in the, in the medical regulatory system that, is bad on its own, even if you have sound money. I mean, you have medical licensing, so, the state medical societies are able to decide on how many doctors are produced every year, right? They control the medical schools, there's accreditation, there's also occupational licensing. And so that's one way of keeping the doctors' incomes high. There was a great historian, unfortunately passed away last year, I think, Ronald Hamaway, who did a study of the movement to institute medical licensing at the turn of the 20th century, and he read their journal, their minutes of their of medical society meetings in the various states, and their concern was not consumer protection, it was, how are we going to keep our incomes up with all these doctors? Well, the answer is, let's not have so many doctors. And this led to a movement to close a lot of the medical schools. There was this Flexner report, which was issued by the commissioned by the Rockefeller Foundation, I believe, which said, well, one problem is we have too darn many medical schools. We need to close about half of them. Well, you know what they closed? They closed the women's medical colleges and the black medical colleges mostly. Surprise, surprise. They didn't touch many of the white and male medical colleges, and that was a way to make sure not too many doctors were produced every year. They also went after something called lodge practice. A lot of people got their medical care for themselves and their families through the lodges they were members of. It was called lodge practice, mutual aid societies, and it was a very successful system, but the organized medicine did not like it because it drove down their incomes, because a doctor would sign a contract with a lodge for a year, and he'd have this guarantee amount of money coming to him through the year, and then as a privilege of membership in the lodge, you and your family members had access to this general practitioner during the year, and people were very happy about it. They interviewed doctors very carefully before deciding whom to sign the contract with. They drilled them. But the organized medicine condemned lodge doctors as, amateurs. They'd gone to private colleges, not Harvard. And they denigrated them. They went to the hospitals and said, don't give privileges to these lodge doctors because we don't like them. And so they ended up driving the whole practice, out of existence. And that's how a lot of low-income working-class people were getting medical care. They solved the problem back then. And yet today, Obama says, how can we get medical care, good medical care to all people? Well, people
and
are solving
break your
the
leg
problem.
And hand you crutches and say, yeah, you better get on your knees and thank me.
That's what I think is so shameful about conservatives. They talk about markets, they hate Obamacare, but they never talk about what really needs to be done. Instead, they say, we have the greatest system in the world, and now it's being messed up. That's nonsense. Many, many people were priced out of it. The price inflation in medical care was much greater than general price inflation, and that's because we don't have true markets, free markets, competitive markets in insurance or medical care.
And you know what you say about the medical association there and everything, I mean, to me, that's the most important lesson that liberals have to learn, is that in virtually every case, regulatory capture was the scheme in the first place. It's not that wonderfully public-spirited professors, as Tom Woods would say, come up with these agencies just to help perfect society a little more. It's always a bunch of rent seekers. It's always the worst, greediest characters in the entire profession of this, that, or the other, including medicine, who conspire with the government to persecute their competition. From the railroads to the bankers to the doctors to the rest of them.
I was just going to say, the railroads wanted the ICC to regulate their rate. The meat packers wanted government to do the inspection, the meat inspection. You're right. In every case, it's not some consumer protection device. It's some incumbent firm protection device, and that's how it works out. It's not a coincidence. You know, look, who's going to have more access to the regulators, you and me? Or the companies, the CEOs of the companies that are working, you know, 24 hours a day on this stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, the way it works in practice, too, is if you have a real legit complaint that you could maybe sue in court, say over an environmental matter, somebody pollutes on your property or something, a company pollutes on your property, certainly here in Texas, and I know on the national level, too, I don't know about in every state, but the headline here always would be that the defense attorney for the company stood up and told the judge, hey, the EPA or the Texas version of the EPA gave us a smiley face on our report card, so everything's fine. And then the judge isn't going to overrule the regulators. The regulators said that they're within the parts per million, and so your case is dismissed.
Right. That's right. And that's happened, yeah, in a lot of different ways. I agree. That's a great insight. So it rigs the system against just sort of regular people. And again, who's going to be more comfortable in the halls of power? The CEOs of these companies, or just regular people who don't know the ins and outs, or too busy making a living so they can get their kids into, you know, through school? And
Who really wants a free market? Somebody who's trying to make it in the world, or somebody who already made it and has a lot at risk?
Right. That's right. You know? That's the last thing that the last thing they would want is real competition.
That's the way I see it. See, I think everybody ought to listen to you, man, because then they'd get it. It's easy, especially for liberals. I can put myself in liberal shoes easier than a conservative's, I guess. And I can see why it is that they believe that libertarians are some kind of right-winger and you just want rich white people and their businesses to be free and whatever, and they don't really understand a Sheldon Richmondian point of view. So I'm glad I had the chance to try to bring it to them.
Well, thanks, Scott. Anytime.
Thanks very much, Sheldon. Appreciate it.
Take care.
All right, everybody. That is the great Sheldon Richmond, vice president of the Future Freedom Foundation and editor of the Future Freedom, their journal. And check out FFF.org for the speaking tour. Him and Jacob going around doing the libertarian angle in the South this week.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Future Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richmond, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of the Future Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for the Future Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's the Future Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richmond at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the thingamajig here, man. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is my website. Keep all my interview archives there. We're streaming live, of course, 3 to 5 weekdays here at the Liberty Express and No Agenda Radio. as well as scotthorton.org, Anomaly Radio, and others, too. Our next guest is the great Philip Weiss, journalist and columnist and keeper of the excellent blog. I shouldn't really call it a blog. It's more than a blog. It's a website, mondoweiss.net. And he's got a excellent stable of writers and new ones all the time, too. And a lot of great stuff going on there at Mondo Weiss. I sure hope that you guys will bookmark it and look at it all the time. Welcome back to the show, Phil. How are you doing?
Great, Scott. Thanks for having me on. And I appreciate the book plug that you just gave. I want to buy that book, Why Peace.
Oh, yeah, it's really good. I think you'll dig it. It's a great collection of essays, really. There's like 50 of them or something.
Well, that's great.
It's really
that's
something
great.
Else. Yeah, good. You hear that, Mark? All right. Hey, by the way, speaking of promoting things, maybe it's over now, or maybe my script blocker just blocked your script, but you guys were doing a fun drive just the other day, at least, anyway, right? Is that right?
We're always doing that, but I don't want to plug that up, you know, but thank you. But, yeah, we're always doing it. They should check it out. Check out the site. If they like it, then they should support it. But, whatever.
Man, I have no problem promoting it at all. I think
thank you.
It's great.
Thank you.
And I think, as long as people are reading it, they will want to support it. So it's not a very hard sell or anything. Just look at mondoweiss.net. The looking is free. The support comes later if you feel like it. That's fair enough.
Great.
All right. So let's talk about the most important thing going on. One of the most important things going on right now that is not getting much coverage anyway, and that is the so-called peace talks. Well, I don't know. I don't want to prejudice it too much. Maybe there's some real peace talks going on, but they've been meeting anyway, right? Something's going on over there. What's the latest from the Palestinian Authority and the Netanyahu government and their negotiations?
Well, I think the peace process is hobbling along at this point. It's hard to take it too seriously, although certainly John Kerry just made his sixth trip out to Israel in the last 6 months or so. So his shuttle diplomacy is continuing. But at the same time, the Israelis are announced that they're going to be demolishing another 2,000 homes in East Jerusalem, Palestinian homes, of course, causing 15,000 Palestinians to be homeless. They've announced 1,500 settlements in the West Bank and others in East Jerusalem. So, and this was necessary politically for Netanyahu to do this, just so he could release some Palestinian prisoners as part of his negotiations, or as one of the conditions for the Palestinians to even talk. So, in order to meet a Palestinian condition, he has to basically to maintain his coalition. He is basically foreclosing any possibility. I mean, there hasn't been a possibility of two-state solution for a long time, but he's just making it more and more clear to the world by taking over East Jerusalem, which is supposed to be the capital of a Palestinian state, and not just taking it over, but foreclosing the possibility of a capital being there, but ethnically cleansing it, Judaizing it. So it's a really ugly process that's taking place before our eyes, and that's what the peace process is. And the United States mumbles stuff about we do not see settlement construction as productive, it's counterproductive, but then they do nothing about it. So it's really kind of laughable, and even the chief Palestinian negotiators were reported to have resigned the other day, and are sort of, it's all hanging on by a thread.
Wow, so it sounds like the kind of thing that they would do just to sort of sabotage the negotiations or something, kind of a big middle finger to the Americans for trying to make them even deal, a big middle finger to the Palestinians for thinking that they're ever going to have any sort of independence there. But you're telling me Netanyahu pretty much had no choice but to do this.
Yeah, well, I think that it's very important for Netanyahu and for the Israel lobby in this country to be engaged in, quote-unquote, peace talks. There has to be a quote-unquote peace process. There's been a peace process for nearly 25 years.
Yeah, just don't agree to anything. Just keep processing.
Yeah, they don't agree to anything. And meanwhile, they take more and more of the Palestinian land.
Yeah, but they don't have to do it right in the middle of the negotiations like this. I mean, they didn't negotiate at all for a couple of years there. It seems like they could have waited until this round was over.
Because the right-wing coalition, it's basically they've got a settler coalition. They've got to appease the settlers inside their coalition. So, I mean, the whole thing is kind of a joke at this point. It's just, it is strictly conflict management. And the problem is that if they really do abandon any pretense of having a peace process, then the Israelis could be blamed for what they're doing. But so since they maintain this this kind of charade, they can claim, well, we're just trying to negotiate. We don't have a real partner for peace. It's just absurd. And the fact that the United States rubber stamps all this is what's, you know, truly pathetic here.
Yeah. Well, and I guess, well, I don't know. There's a few different directions we should go here. It's hard for me to figure out which one. I guess let me go back to what you said about the possibility of a Palestinian state is now impossible. By that you mean it would be too difficult to remove the settlers, even if you had an Israeli government that wanted to remove the settlers from the West Bank. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. If you drive around the West Bank, I mean, you're just seeing an area in which, in substantial portions of the West Bank, there's a lot more Jewish settlement than there is Palestinian life. And that's because the Palestinians have been forced out into Area A, these urban areas. They've been cantonized. And there's just there's Israelis who vote in Israeli elections all over that territory. And close to 600,000 of them all told in East Jerusalem and West Bank, or 650,000. And, you know, you're just not going to remove them. And you're not going to remove the ideology that inside Israel, that all this land is ours, this land was given us by God, Jerusalem was given us by God. That ideology has really taken root inside Israeli Zionist culture. And it's just, it means there's not going to be a viable Palestinian state. You could create a Bantustan, that's what they want to do, but any semblance of rights for Palestinians, including the right of refugees to return to their homes, is just off the table. But Scott, I wanted to tell you about my biggest scoop of my life, which I had last week.
Well, okay. I read what you wrote. Which was the biggest scoop of your life?
Well, I was there at Yeshiva University in New York when Sheldon Adelson said we shouldn't talk to Iran, we should nuke it.
Mm-hmm.
And Obama shouldn't talk to Iran, he should be nuking Iran, firing an atomic weapon into the desert and killing just a bunch of salamanders, but then saying the next one's in Tehran. Anyway, this threat issued by the casino mogul who pays for Republican presidential candidates, I got it on videotape, and it went viral, so that was the biggest scoop I've ever had. I was really pleased. And the point that I think is really shocking about this is that I mentioned that touches it to the into the peace process is, first, this is the guy who paid for a lot of Republican expenses in the 2000 election that mm-hmm. got George Bush into the White House. And George
hey, that's
Bush
an understatement. He spent how much money? Hundreds of millions of dollars, right?
Well, in 2000, I don't know about, in 2000 he spent several hundred thousand that I'm aware of. But that's 13 years ago. The reason I bring it up is that he did that because he was so frightened by the Clinton peace process, the Camp David peace process. And the result was that George Bush said, he said to Sheldon Adelson, well, I can't be more Catholic than the Pope. I can't be more Israeli than Netanyahu or Olmert, he was saying, but I'll do what you want. And basically he shut down the peace process that Clinton had started. And that was what Sheldon Adelson achieved. And now we see what the quality of this man's thinking is. This is a guy who says we should nuke Iran, and he's had so much power over American policy, it's incredible.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I had misunderstood you. I thought you were talking about the last election, but you're talking about back in 2000.
No, in 2000. And, I mean, he got close this last time because, you know, he was supporting Gingrich, then Romney. He was the leading backer of these Republicans. But it's just, if one of them had gotten in, I mean, I know, we don't care for the Democrat either, but if one of them had gotten in, would they have been nuking Iran? I just don't, you know, this is, you're seeing a thug issuing threats on the stage of a leading American Jewish institution, and the people there are smiling and clapping. It's really a horror show.
Yeah, well, it was amazing. I'm sorry that I did not put together that was
on.
Your scoop.
I'm
saw
just
the
giving
video.
You a hard time. No, but I brought it up just because I'm proud and because it touches into these other things. And then, you know, then you throw in the fact that Obama's Iran policy, you know, I think it's the best thing Obama ever did was backing down on the Syria threat, and the consequence has been an opening to Iran. Well, the Israel lobby's going nuts over this. Sheldon Adelson's going nuts. And who did Obama meet with last week? He meets with four leaders of the Israel lobby and basically agrees that he's going to – he won't – he says, I don't want Congress to tighten any sanctions, and I won't lessen sanctions during the next round of negotiations with the Iranians. So they're tying his hands for these negotiations. The Israel lobby is, mm-hmm. by all reports.
Well, yeah, I mean, and they're making it pretty pretty plain, too, in all the different newspapers or whatever. It's not any kind of underground thing. They're marching right up to Capitol Hill. They're making it known to all of their friends and all the major papers to write an essay about what a great job AIPAC is doing trying to get and having great success in getting congressmen on board for them and how... Oh, yeah, Obama's had to beg them to allow him to... Can you guys please freeze with the anti-peace lobbying? Give me a week to try to just get through the next few days. He's got to beg them and grant audiences to all their leaders in the Oval Office to get them to listen to him and stuff. Like, God dang,
man. It's embarrassing.
It's crazy to watch, I think. I mean, Israel's the size of Maryland or something. And
New Jersey, yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
even.
My whole attitude is take a hike. I don't care. Why should I care any more about this little country than any other country
Absolutely.
In the world? You don't see Mongolia lording it over the U.S. Senate like this, you know?
No, and you don't see our Secretary of State meeting six times with, you know, the Prime Minister of a country of 6 million. And then the other part of it is that the other week, John Kerry had the temerity to say, our Iranian policy is not going to be governed by fear tactics. No reference to Israel in that statement. But immediately the Anti-Defamation League came out and blasted Kerry, saying that he should not be criticizing Israel publicly. And what happens? Foxman, the guy who made that statement from the Anti-Defamation League, he goes to the White House and meets Obama. Samantha Power, the ambassador to the UN, is praising him. Why do these people have power? That's what we have to ask. And the reason is simple, because they are perceived to deliver a lot of money from wealthy conservative Jews to the Democratic Party. And people who are conservative on Israel, people who love Israel and the Jewish community. And that's my problem as a Jew, because I have to break that Jewish identity with Zionism. But it's also a major political problem, because these right-wing ultra-Zionists have so kind of intimidated the politicians and convinced them that there's only one way to get Jewish support, and that is to be a hardliner on Israel.
Mm-hmm. And
the Jewish community organizations bear responsibility here, because they've signed off in large part.
The thing of it is, though, every time I hear liberal Jewish critics of the Israeli state, it seems to me like you guys are all way more Jewish than the Pope, man, because the Likudniks are, well, they're like Republicans, and they have their little kind of miniature version of the American empire there. And just like the American empire, they're killing their own society. You don't have to be brilliant to just apply your imagination to the short term, even, or medium term, whatever you call it, future of Israel, to see how that Netanyahu today is riding Israel's toe tag. You know, they at some point they're going to have to outright admit that they have annexed the West Bank and Gaza, and then at that point they are still going to obviously completely refuse equal citizenship to the Arab, Muslim, and Christian communities living there. And then they're either going to have to force march them out like Andrew Jackson and the Trail of Tears into the Jordan River, or they're going to have to outright admit that they're not just Jim Crow, but Mississippi during the Jim Crow, South Africa, minority rule. And how are they even going to last till 2025 like this or 2030? I mean, you would think that if anybody cared about Israel, they would be telling all these right-wingers that they're ridiculous and dangerous. But everybody seems to go along like, well, like it's 2002 in America, and whatever George Bush thinks, he's the most grown-up guy in the room. I guess he knows what he's doing.
Right, and there's a lot more. I mean, when you talk about the American empire, there's actually a lot more criticism of the American empire in our discourse than there is of this suicidal Israeli empire, which is dragging us down.
I mean, you know, America can afford it a lot more than Israel can, you know? We're safe way over here in North America, and we got $1 trillion and all that.
Right, but, I mean, tell me the truth, Scott. If Israel went down the tubes, you wouldn't really. I mean, how much would you care? I mean, down the tubes, you'd obviously care if a lot of people got hurt. No one wants to see people hurt. But if, you know, the Jewish state of Israel ceased to exist and a democracy existed there, I think both of us would be happy.
Yeah, I don't care. I mean, it seems to me like, if they would just, well, and see, I'm a libertarian, so at the very most, I want the most minimal state. So if the state's only job was just actually guaranteeing the rights of the people and being their security force of everyone equally, then you could have a no-state solution or a one-state solution, and it would be fine. The only reason it matters whether Jews or Arabs are in charge is because of how they're going to use the state to lord it over each other and slave each other. And that's the problem with the one-state solution, too, is there'll just be a civil war. I mean, that's the whole thing, is the disruption of all of this, is people are going to die in this one way or the other. This is a really bad way of doing it. And I can't help but think that as mean as it is and as unfair as it is, that they could just go back to the 67 borders and deny the right of return to inside the 67 borders, give up, you know, force all the settlers out, give up the West Bank and Gaza, let them have their little Palestinian state, and Israel could probably survive as a so-called Jewish democracy for at least a much longer term if they actually wanted that. But it seems to me like they would rather destroy themselves trying to build a greater Israel that they don't even have the people to populate anyway. And there's a bunch of red Indians in the way. What are you going to do with them? You know?
Yeah, I think it's a brilliant analysis you made, because the truth is that these people could have gotten away with this. They would have reached a deal with the Palestinians of the West Bank and the Palestinians inside Israel to say, hey, basically, let's divide this up among ourselves in a, you know, not a fair way. You're just going to get a small chunk of it, but we're going to sell out the refugees, and who also have a right to be there. And I think the Palestinians of the West Bank might have gone along with that at some point and said, okay, we don't want them back either, or whatever they might have said, if we get, you know, so much territory out of the deal. And maybe Israel could have pulled it off. But at this point, I agree, they're surrounded by the indigenous population in a lot of different countries who regard them as an illegitimate state, and they're succeeding in delegitimizing them because they're delegitimizing themselves.
Yeah. Well, and their population is falling as they're trying to expand into territory where other people live. I mean, the whole thing just doesn't even make sense at all. And you know, I think, and I'm not the world's expert on all of this, you know, Phil, you know, I have a lot more about it than me, but
more or less,
Arafat back in 88 and Hamas back in at least 06 or something, I saw Hamas on the freaking Charlie Rose show saying, just give us 67 borders.
Right.
And then I don't think he said, forget the right of return, but his silence meant we'll even say forget the refugees from inside the 67 borders, just give us 67 borders and we'll recognize Israel. And as soon as he says that, Netanyahu says, yeah, but you also have to tell us how Jewish we are. Like, what are you even talking about? Just moving the goalposts now.
Yeah, you know? Outrageous. And I think what I would emphasize that we should understand in this whole business is that not only was Hamas saying that, not only was the Fatah and the PA saying that, but the Arab Peace Initiative, you had 22 Arab countries mm-hmm. basically saying, hey, we'll massage this refugee issue. We'll help you deal with it. We will back you up on it so that there's not, this doesn't become a festering issue. So they were going to help sell out the refugees, the Arab countries were, just to end this problem. And Israel could not grab that deal or could not try to effect that deal, the Arab Peace Initiative of 2002. And so when we ask someday who lost Israel, I think we're going to have to say that Israel lost Israel and the Israel lobby lost Israel. Yeah. Because the Israel lobby didn't muscle them on this and say, hey, you know, we're sick of carrying the water for you here, holding the bag. Cut the deal.
Right. Yeah, you know, MJ Rosenberg had a piece a few years back where he said the peaceniks were right. I forget the title, but something like the peaceniks were right. And he goes back in time to the 50s or something. Like, I don't even think he goes back to the founding or anything. He goes pretty far back in time. And he's, every single time the Israeli government got into a mess with their neighbors, the peaceniks, before it happened, said, no, don't do it, because here's what's going to happen if you do. And every time the peaceniks were right and the warmongers did it anyway and the terrible uh-huh. results happened. And then he goes through 15 examples or whatever that leads us up to the present day where Israel's about to cease to exist at the hands of those who claim they're protecting it the most. You know?
It's amazing. It's really amazing. And, I mean, I don't know how many... I mean, the question is... I mean, I'm always amazed by your degree of understanding about this. I guess it leaves me wondering, how many Americans do you think have any understanding of this question? Is that awareness growing? And when is that awareness going to make it easier for politicians in this country to say, nah, I'm not standing with Israel on this. I don't like what Israel's doing. What's your answer to this question?
Basically, my judgment on that is always, what did I used to think? And what I used to think was, I don't know much about it because TV will never shoot it straight and just give you a basic, even outline of what the hell is going on here. So, as far as I used to understand, I guess Palestine is more or less sort of a city-state next to Israel there, and they won't quit with the suicide bombing or something. That's basically my impression, you know, back when I was just right. going off my impression. There was never any explanation... I assume that this is what everybody else thinks too. They have never had it explained to them that ever since 67 there's been this permanent martial law military occupation of the next door neighbors, the ones who were pushed there in the first place, but right. who are now even under martial law even longer now than the Soviets occupied Eastern Europe, and that it's a pretty raw deal and whatever. I don't think people understand that. I only really started to understand these issues after the Iraq War, when I come to find out just how much of a role not just the neoconservative Israel Firsters, but even Ariel Sharon himself had in getting us into that war, and that pissed me off. And then also I ended up learning a lot more about how even since 1996 and even before that, Bin Laden had said that his war against America was because of our support for Israel. And not that they're good Jews living happy lives, but that what they're doing is wrong. And we're helping them do things that are horrible to people. And so I really, really, really resent not only that, but then Sharon and Netanyahu both especially and all their acolytes in America taking advantage of September 11th to bend American policy even worse to their worst goals. Like, screw them, man. Let them be pushing the sea at this point. Right. And I don't mean every civilian there, but that, as far as the Zionist project, fooey with all of them, you know? I used to not care. Now I'm against it.
Yes. I, you know, the funny thing is, I got into it the exact same way you did. You know, I had never been to Israel. I grew up in the American Jewish community, but not intimately involved in that community, but certainly very strong sense of myself as Jewish. I didn't get to Israel until I was 50 years old in 2006, and the reason I went there is the Iraq War. The reason I went there is because my brother had said to me before the Iraq War started, what do you think of this war? I was against the Vietnam War, but my Jewish newspaper says that this war could be good for Israel. Well, that word went out in the Jewish community, and that was a big reason of that why that war happened. And certainly the neoconservatives wanted that war in some large or small measure, because it would they thought it would help Israel's security. And that is what I had to unpack. So I was a very similar place to you. And I've come out of it in a similar place to you, where I think, if this place ceases to exist as a Jewish state, whatever they call themselves, and it becomes a democracy, fine. I think what we both understand is that there's violence in the future. They've created a situation where there's the only answer is violence, unfortunately. And that's why I support the boycott movement, which is nonviolent.
Well, my ultimate argument is simply that the U.S. government has to stop intervening in these things, because it's sort of like with economics. They lend their weight to this side or the other. They end up kind of creating a bubble that can't really sustain itself but for their intervention. Sort of like propping Karzai up in power in Afghanistan.
Right.
Once the inflation of his power goes away, with our military might and our inflation, then his power will go away. And it's the same sort of thing here, where it's gonna work itself out however it works out, but it's gonna work itself out quickest as soon as the U.S. government takes a hands-off point
with you
and stops backing one side over the other.
I agree with you, and stops infantilizing other people.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. And if the other thing is, there's a few different things, but I guess I'll just add a couple of footnotes, since I said that Ariel Sharon helped lie us into war. Agents of Influence by Robert Dreyfus and The Spies Who Pushed for War by Julian Borger both talk about Ariel Sharon's special project, where he set up his own office of special plans in Israel, where they made up fake intelligence in English to funnel straight into the, Feith, Wurmser, Pearl, Hadley stovepipe, vice president's office stovepipe there. So if anybody wants to look at
that. Check it out, Scott.
Hey, listen, your blog is so great, and
thanks,
congrats,
man,
on the Adelson scoop. I'm sorry, I didn't even realize that was your scoop when I saw the video there. But
No, don't worry about it.
It's the great Philip Weiss and his great crew there at MondoWeiss.net. Thanks again, Phil.
I'll talk to you soon, man.
All right, see you guys tomorrow. Thanks for listening.